Progress.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good evening. Really great to see you all. First thing I want to do is thank Anne-Laure for her really memorable and important talk that she gave last week that's caused all of us to be practicing smiling and gratitude, two of the great practices that you can do. So she really got us into that, so I really appreciate that, and I know you do too. Also, I want to thank those of you who were there in person. It was really quite a thrill to have a room full of bodhisattvas all together. It was really, really nice. The next thing I want to do is to mention, with a great deal of sorrow, two more passings from our community. And this is, first one is someone that many of you probably know. Our dear friend and senior priest from our community in Bellingham, the Red Cedar Zen community, Edie Norton, Shuko Zaku, Autumn Light, Sitting in Emptiness, passed away yesterday morning in the early hours. And our guiding teacher of Red Cedar, Tim Burnett, who's here at seminar, told me today that her last words, after being silent for 24 hours, saying nothing for 24 hours, she said the following words: "Access the light, for this is a solemn moment." And she was a very careful person, so these were considered words, and when someone asked her to repeat it, she said the exact same words again in the same way: "Access the light, for this is a solemn moment." And 2 hours, and then she said nothing else, and she died 2 hours later, about 5 a.m. yesterday. And her memorial is going to be at Red Cedar on March the 30th, a Saturday. And it will be on Zoom too, Tim tells me. So those of you who knew her or who would want to participate in her memorial or funeral can know it's on March the 30th. Edie wrote a wonderful memoir, Autumn Light, My 50 Years in Zen. And a number of us read that before we went down to Tassajara in 2019. It scared us. I'm going to read you the blurb that I wrote on the back of it, because it tells you what the book is like. "Over many years of Zen practice, I've come to feel that Buddhist enlightenment is nothing more or less than being a normal functioning person, capable of living a full human life right to the end. It turns out that this simple normal thing is actually rare, and that it takes some doing. In Autumn Light, My 50 Years in Zen, Edie Norton, Zen priest, shows us her long life of enduring what time in the world will do to you, and how, through the simple process of paying honest attention to what happens, while maintaining the disciplined practice of sitting in the silence of the purely present moment, an ordinary person can come to great wisdom and compassion. Especially moving is Edie's detailed description, by far the longest part of her story, though it occupies only 3 months of her life. Her description of her monastic training period at Tassajara Zen Monastery, a place I know very well. It is the best and most thorough description of what happens there that I have ever read. I am so moved by this book, and I know you will be too. Thanks, Edie. Autumn Light. It is really something. She lived to be 89, and 3 months of her life take up about, at Tassajara, take up, I don't know, about half, at least half of the book. Anyway, she was a really wonderful priest and one of the pillars of the community at Red Cedar, and we're all going to miss her. Also, I note with possibly even more sadness the death of a close friend of mine, the poet Lynn Higinian. Lynn was one of the really great poets of my generation. We were in a sort of, whatever you call it, you know, coterie of poets trying to write in the same way. And she was the best of us. And a wonderful human being and a kind and thoughtful friend who I'm going to miss a lot. Her work was really, really important for me. Knowing she was coming toward the end of her life, I've been reading her again, and I just finished reading her book, Saga Circus. And I'm going to just read you a few of her lines. She was such a profound and generous thinker. Life can't be studied as if it were the non-life of something lived by someone studying. Isn't all autobiography about which I'm disposed to be uncertain, about how things can't cohere, sentimental? Doubt grasps at the very thing it doubts. Silence is the name for it, clearly perceived as the day fades and its fading pales further. The first element to impose its influence on me was my life. But life cannot stem the onslaught of meaningfulness. I've committed that to paper, that of which one cannot speak. I, registering a boundary. That's sentimental, which is what all ruptures generate and all gaps demarcate. And there's no and so, nor but, nor meanwhile that can limit the irony. Irony is the limit. And from another poem, the next poem. We are exposed. There is nothing here but exposure. Every wave, even as it curls over the light, produces exposure. Every thought is crossed by its own frame of illimitable, transient foam. What an amazing talent and ability to live in words and share that with us. So I've been thinking about Lynn all the time for a while now. Okay, now I begin my Dharma talk proper. It's been a while since I've had the great honor and privilege of addressing you all at the Dharma seminar. The last time I did so, I brought up Dogen's famous text about Zazen, Fukan Zazengi, since appreciating Zazen is our theme, one of our themes for the practice period. So I talked about Fukan Zazengi, which is a text, a very famous text, that Dogen wrote soon after he returned to Japan from China, and he was full of faith and enthusiasm for this new practice of Zazen that he had learned from his teacher Rujing, and he was a young man at the time, in his early 20s. Throughout Buddhist history, it has always seemed obvious to everyone that the aim of practice is enlightenment, realization, awakening. That was the point of doing the practice. That was the goal of the practice. But Rujing showed Dogen that what the Buddha actually taught was much more subtle and profound than that. Rujing taught that realization is boundless and wondrous, and therefore it cannot possibly be an object of mind or a state of mind produced by your activity. It is far more pervasive and profound, just as the Mahayana Sutras say. So awakening is not something that happens. It's the luminous quality of being itself. At the sitting this past Saturday, I quoted Suzuki Roshi, who says, more or less, these are not his exact words, but he says in the quote that I read, that our practice is not gradual. It is sudden awakening. Because when you practice sincerely and with commitment, everyday life, moment after moment, is awakening. And awakening is beautiful. Anyway, Dogen was a young man. He came home, and he was really excited, and he wanted to share his enthusiasm for Zazen with everyone. So sometimes they translate the title, Fukan Zazengi, Universal Recommendation of Zazen for Everyone, something like that. So last time I talked, I spoke about the opening couple of paragraphs of the text. And I pointed out that in those paragraphs, Dogen does something that he so often does, very characteristic of his teaching. He flips the script sort of inside out or upside down. He shows you how something that you always thought obviously was this way turns out to be not that way at all. So we always thought that Buddha and Bodhidharma determinedly sat Zazen in order to awaken. That's the way we understood their stories. But Dogen says, no, actually, it's the opposite. He points out that Buddha and Bodhidharma sat Zazen for the rest of their lives after they awakened. That they were not sitting to become awakened. They were sitting because they were awakened. And this is true also for us. That's what I was saying several weeks ago. So tonight I take up from there and talk about the rest of the text. And tonight I will finish it. So I'm quoting now Dogen. For studying Zen, one should have quiet quarters, be moderate in food and drink. So this is something we don't talk about much, but actually it's really important. Because if you devote yourself to Zazen, little by little, the Zazen begins to colonize your entire life. If you're going to get up early and sit, probably you'll go to bed early. Maybe you'll want to eat more moderately, live a little more quietly, live a life that kind of is built around your daily sitting. Even though there are no rules and restrictions, probably there is a way of life. Nowadays we say a lifestyle, a phrase many decades old that I still can't get used to. It seems bizarre. Lifestyle. Anyway, there's probably some way of life that you're going to live that's going to be consonant with your commitment to do zazen. And of course, so this is your whole way of life. Isn't that a big subject? You know, well, he mentions a couple of sentences. Then he goes on to give some inner instructions. Now here's what he says next. Cast aside all involvements and discontinue all affairs. Do not think of good or evil. Do not deal with right or wrong. Halt the revolutions of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop the calculations of thoughts, ideas, and perceptions. Do not intend to make a Buddha, much less be attached to sitting still. Those of you who are familiar with this text realize I'm using an unusual translation. This is Karl Bielefeld's translation, not the one that you would have chanted. So it's a little different. Anyway, that's what he says in Carl's English words. Now, of course, Dogen understands that you cannot just tell your mind to forget about everything and be quiet, and it's going to do that. Your mind doesn't necessarily listen to you, which is a strange thing when you think about it. You know, most likely you can tell your arm, you know, raise up, and it's going to do that. But you can't tell your mind, you know, be quiet, be happy, be grateful. And it's going to do that. Maybe it will do that sometimes, but not necessarily. And Dogen knows this. So what he's saying is that when you're sitting in zazen, it's not the time to figure stuff out. It's not the time to deploy your excellent discriminating mind. It's the time to set everything aside, including all efforts to improve yourself or get enlightened. Just sit without any special intention other than to sit. And don't, above all, make sitting into something special that you can get attached to and feel prideful of, making yourself into some kind of special person who is devoted to sitting. So that's the spirit of your sitting. Next, he comes forth with a whole bunch of very concrete and practical instructions. He says, in the place where you regularly sit, so it's good to sit in the same place all the time, in the place where you regularly sit, spread a thick mat and use a cushion on top of it. Sit in either the full cross-legged or half cross-legged position. For the full position, first place your right foot on your left thigh, then place your left foot on your right thigh. For the half position, simply rest your left foot on your right thigh. Loosen your robe and belt and arrange them properly. Next, place your right hand on your left foot and your left hand on that right palm. Press the tips of your thumbs together. Then straighten your body and sit erect. Do not lean to the left or right or forward or backward. Your ears should be in line with your shoulders and your nose in line with your navel. Press your tongue against the front of your palate and close your lips and teeth. The eyes should always remain open. Breathe gently through the nose. Once you have regulated your posture, take a breath and exhale fully and swing to the left and to the right. So we've all heard those instructions before, and even though maybe we cannot do them exactly in the way he describes, we do get the point that our posture is very important and that we should sit with respect and with great attention for the way our body is when we sit. And again, he alternates between practical physical instructions and inner instructions. And now he says something that is a very famous line in the text. Sit fixedly. Think of not thinking. How do you think of not thinking? Non-thinking. This is the essential art of Zazen. So this phrase, along with the phrase we talked about last time, that appears earlier in the text, take the backward step to turn the light inward. These two short sections are the two most important instructions Dogen gives for the way we want to pay attention during Zazen. Taking the backward step means not paying attention to objects, and the number one object that we're used to paying attention to is ourself. We are objects to ourselves. It's astounding to think of that, but it's absolutely true. We are other to ourselves. We think of ourselves. Take the backward step means don't pay attention to objects. Instead, pay attention to the mind itself, to the awareness itself, to the cognition itself. So that's what he says earlier. And now he talks specifically about thoughts, how you practice with thoughts. He says, sit fixedly, and what he means by that is sit still. No moving, within and without. And then think not thinking. How do you do this? Non-thinking. So this teaching is not original to Dogen. It comes from a dialogue of a Tang Dynasty master, Yaoshan, that Dogen is quoting. And it sounds enigmatic, but really it's quite a straightforward and simple thing. There is, on the one hand, as we all know, thinking your thoughts, working out problems, making plans, reviewing things that have happened, or maybe just daydreaming, wool gathering. So there's thinking on the one hand. On the other hand, there maybe could be not thinking. The mind could be empty, blank, or maybe fully absorbed with a perception or a sensation, or maybe you're in some kind of mystical reverie that isn't really thinking exactly. So that's the other extreme. Thinking on the one hand, not thinking on the other hand. But think not thinking, or non-thinking, which is meant to be the same thing, is the middle way between these two. There may or may not be thought, but you are not engaging the thought. You are letting it come and go. The thought floats up. You didn't ask it to be there. Did you ever think of that? You know, a thought comes up. You didn't say, I want to think this now. It's just there. How did that happen? It floats up, but it floats away. Maybe another one floats up. Maybe one that's similar to the previous one. But it also floats away. Because you're not chasing any thoughts. You are sitting still. You're not moving. The thoughts may be moving, but your mind is not moving with them. That's what he means by think, not thinking, non-thinking, the essential art of Zazen. It's actually not that hard to do. Then he says, Zen is not meditation. And I think he means this with all sincerity. He says, this is direct quoting, Zazen is not the practice of dhyana. Dhyana means meditation. Zazen is not the practice of dhyana. It is simply the Dharma gate of ease and joy. It is the practice and verification of ultimate bodhi, ultimate awakening. The koan realized, brackets and cages cannot get to it. So meditation is a means to an end. You're meditating for a reason. But Zazen is not a means to an end. It is the end itself. It is already the verification of awakening. It's complete all by itself. And it is perfectly pure. Nothing can hurt Zazen. Then he says, if you grasp the point of this practice, you are like the dragon gaining the water or the tiger taking to the mountains. You should realize that when right thought is present, dullness and agitation are, from the start, struck aside. So Zazen is a superpower. When you do Zazen, you feel confident, you feel grounded, and you feel secure. Nothing can defeat you like nothing defeats a dragon in the water or a tiger in the mountains. Nothing can disturb you. Again, he says, then, now, quite matter-of-factly, when you are finished sitting, move slowly and get up calmly. Don't be hasty or rough. Considering the past, we see that transcending the profane and surpassing the holy, shedding this body while seated and fleeing this life while standing, are totally subject to this power. Surely then, to grasp the turning of the opportunity through a finger, a pole, a needle, or a mallet, and to present the verification of the accord with a whisk, a fist, a staff, or a shout, these are not to be understood through the discriminations of thinking, much less can they be known through the practice and verification of supernormal powers. They must represent conduct beyond sound and form. How could they fail to provide a standard beyond knowledge and understanding? So what he's saying here is that all the amazing accomplishments of Dharma practice and awakening that we're aware of, from being able to die at will when you're sitting in meditation or standing, as Buddhist sages of the past have been recorded to have done. You know, after I cross over that line, I'm going to die. And then they walk and they cross over the line and they die right there. Or I'm going to go sit in meditation and I'm going to die tomorrow morning. And they sit in meditation and they pass tomorrow morning. Or the miracle of being suddenly awakened just by the words or gestures of Zen masters, just like the ancients used to do. He's saying, these wondrous things cannot be accomplishments of the mind or body. They cannot possibly be ordinary human attainments. They must be mere signs of the ineffable power of this Zazen that he's talking about. that goes beyond our various explanations and so forth. Therefore, he says, it does not matter whether one is very smart or very stupid, there is no distinction between those of sharp and dull faculties. Single-minded exertion is itself pursuit of the way. Practice and verification are by nature undefiled. Advancement to enlightenment is just an everyday affair. So these last two sentences are very important. He says, practice and verification are by nature undefiled. In Dogen's way of looking at things, the word defiled means dualistic. It's a synonym for dualism. So when he says practice and verification or awakening, that's what he means by verification. When he says practice and awakening are undefiled, he means they cannot possibly be dualistic. They cannot possibly be two opposing concepts or two different moments of experience. Therefore, it is way too small-minded to think of awakening or enlightenment as an experience that you do not yet have and seek. It can't be that. It must be the nature of every moment and every experience in every moment, no matter what you think it is. The moment, the literal, actual moment of the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and awakening can only be this moment, right now, moment after moment. This is why he's going to say in a couple paragraphs, there's no point in running around looking for the way when it's right here in your own house. And then it occurs to me that Buddha has a better sense of humor than we thought he did. He invented Zoom so that we could actually each practice literally in our own house and not think we have to go to the Zen Center to practice. We don't, because wherever you are, that's where the practice is. Back to Dogen. In our world and other quarters, from the Western heaven to the Eastern Earth, all equally maintain the Buddha seal. While each enjoys its own style of teaching, they devote themselves only to sitting. They are obstructed by fixedness. Though they speak of 10,000 distinctions and 1,000 differences, they only study Zen and pursue the way. So, everyone can do this practice. And simply to do it faithfully is enough. You don't have to accomplish something. You just have to do it. And although there are a million teachings and a million ways of understanding these teachings, and they're all good, all of them, he says, come down to Zazen in the end. And all of them are included in Zazen. Then he says the part that I referred to a moment ago. Why abandon the seat in your own home to wander in vain through the dusty regions of another land? If you make one false step, you miss what is right before you. Since you have already attained the functioning essence of a human body, do not pass your days in vain. When one takes care of the essential function of the way of the Buddha, who can carelessly enjoy the spark from a flint? Verily, form and substance are like the dew on the grass, and the fortunes of life are like a lightning flash, emptied in an instant, lost in a moment. So he says, what he's saying is that wow, you are a lucky person. You have the tremendous blessing of a human body. So you already have everything you need. All of the awakening is right there in the package. You don't need to run around looking for something else. However, life goes by very quickly. It's really spooky and scary, don't you think? How quickly life flies by. So do not waste time. Practice right now. Always, always right now. Next, he says this, eminent students of the Dharma, long accustomed to groping for the elephant, pray do not doubt the true dragon. I'm giving you the true scoop here. Don't lose track of it. Apply yourselves to the way that points directly at reality. Honor the man, the person. Honor the person who is through with learning and free of action. Accord with the awakening of all the Buddhas, succeed to the samadhi of all the ancestors. If you act this way for a long time, you will be this way. In other words, if you practice like this, you will be like this. Your treasure store will open of itself, and you will use it as you will. I'm just remembering now, I think this is true. I just remember when I read that line. I think in Japanese, maybe there's a Japanese speaker here among us, but I think in Buddhist Japanese, treasure house is a homonym for my name, my Dharma name. My Dharma name is not treasure house, but treasure house is Zoketsu. I think, because I remember once Hoitsu Roshi wrote on my Rakasu, your treasure house will open of itself, because it's a pun on my Dharma name. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Anyway, that's the end of the Fukan Zazengi. So this is it. This is the way is really simple. It's really straightforward. It's very, very beautiful. And if you practice it, you will be astonished at the way in which your life unfolds beautifully without a lot of striving or frustration. And I think that many of you listening to me right now would only have to think about it for a minute and say, you know what? In my experience, that is actually true. So I conclude now with quoting one more passage, a little short-ish passage from Suzuki Roshi, since that's the other theme of our practice period. This one is about bowing, the practice of bowing, literally bowing. After Zazen, we bow to the floor 9 times. In San Francisco Zen Center, they do that in the morning service. They bow 9 times. I don't think that's done anywhere else in the world. I think Suzuki Roshi thought that these Americans needed to bow more. Usually you bow 3 times, you know. But I think he thought, he took a look at these American kids and he said, they need to bow more. So he made it 3 times 3 bows, 9 bows. But I don't think anywhere in Japan they do 9 bows. But he says, after Zazen, we bow to the floor 9 times. By bowing, we are giving up ourselves. To give up ourselves means to give up our dualistic ideas. So there's no difference between Zazen practice and bowing. Usually, to bow means to pay our respects to something which is more worthy of respect than ourselves. But when you bow to Buddha, you should have no idea of Buddha. You just become one with Buddha. You are already Buddha himself. when you become one with Buddha, one with everything that exists, you find the true meaning of being. When you forget all your dualistic ideas, everything becomes your teacher, and everything becomes an object of worship. When everything exists within your big mind, all dualistic relationships fall away. There's no distinction between heaven and earth, man and woman, teacher and disciple. Sometimes a man bows to a woman. Sometimes a woman bows to a man. Sometimes the disciple bows to the master. Sometimes the master bows to the disciple. A master who cannot bow to his disciple cannot bow to Buddha. Sometimes the master and disciple bow together to Buddha. Sometimes we might bow to cats and dogs. In your big mind, everything has the same value. Everything is Buddha. You see something or hear a sound, and there you have everything, just as it is. In your practice, you should accept everything as it is, giving to each thing the same respect given to a Buddha. That's where Buddhahood is. Then Buddha bows to Buddha, and you bow to yourself. That's the real bow. If you do not have this firm conviction of big mind in your practice, your bow will be dualistic. When you are just yourself, you bow to yourself in its truest sense, and you are one with everything. Only when you are you yourself can you bow to everything in its true sense. Bowing is a very serious practice. You should be prepared to bow even in your last moment. When you cannot do anything except bow, you should do it. This kind of conviction is necessary. Bow with this spirit, and all the precepts, all the teachings are yours, and you will possess everything within your big mind. That's a very wonderful passage about bowing, but it might say everything that you ever need to know about Zen practice. At Everyday Zen, from the beginning, we have a very kind of stripped down, simplified practice. We don't do that much ritual, and so we don't do that much bowing. But lately, we've been doing it a little bit more, and I don't know what people think about it. Maybe some people like it, maybe some people don't. I think a lot of people are allergic to ritual because it seems stilted or pious. But when you hear Suzuki Roshi talk about it, it seems anything but. And I think the great thing is to be free to do the ritual with your whole heart, and just as free not to do it. And personally, I don't mind at all if people don't want to bow, or maybe they can't bow, or don't want to chant. It doesn't matter to me at all. And I like it that in Everyday Zen, there are some people, like we have some Jewish practitioners who don't want to bow to Buddha. It's not good for their Jewish practice. And that doesn't matter to me at all. I think it's wonderful. So you don't have to bow, but bowing is a great practice. Bowing to your true self, your Buddha self. Buddha just means the awakened one. That's you. To bow is to take yourself seriously. So there was a 50th anniversary edition of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind that came out a few years ago. And I think I have lots of different copies of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, you know, stashed here and there in my house. And I found a 50th anniversary edition, and I think I had never read before, just the other day, the afterword for that edition that was written by David Chadwick. And it's really good. I recommend it if you have that edition. It tells about the influence that the book has had over these last 50 years. It's almost a miraculous influence. And in his afterword, David mentions the Estonian poet Jan Kaplinski, who died in 2021. And Jan Kaplinski was somebody that I knew because for a while he lived in Canada and he used to practice with our group in Canada, and I would see him when I went up there for retreats. He was really quite a lively, amazing person and a really good poet. He was like a lot of poets around the world, not so much in America, but around the world. Poets are also politicians, you know. He was like a member of parliament in Estonia. And he was also once, at least once, maybe more than once, nominated for a Nobel Prize in literature. And his literary work and his political work were both really influenced by his Zen practice. And he wrote a poem about Zen mind, beginner's mind, that I'll close with. And David quotes the poem in his afterword. But you know, a funny thing. When I was thinking about this, I went to my shelf and I had a book by Jan Kaplinski that he gave me in 1996. And in the book, he had handwritten this poem. I had totally forgotten that. But anyway, here's the poem that David quotes. And it's about how Zen mind, beginner's mind, the book, has had this amazing effect. I know it has had this effect on my life somehow. Like, how did that happen? This one little book has this big effect on the lives of so many people. So here's Jan Kaplinski's poem. Shinryu Suzuki, a little Japanese living and teaching in California, couldn't be my teacher, one of my non-teachers. A little lit match from God's matchbox. Sea wind soon blew out, somewhere between California and Estonia, somewhere between East and West, between somewhere and nowhere. Nobody can find out what remained of him after the wind has blown and the tide come and gone, the white sand as smooth as before. But his smile from the back cover of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind has silently infected book after book on my shelves, and perhaps the shelves themselves, and the walls, and the wallpaper, too. This is great, right? Wonderful poem. Okay, that's the end. Before we go into groups, I want to remind you, in case I'm going to miss some of you when the groups happen, which is once in a while does occur, that on Friday, we're going to have our ritual, speaking of ritual and bowing, for Mahaprajapati, our first woman Buddhist ancestor. I think it's happening at 4 o'clock in the afternoon online, and I think that I forgot to check this out, but I'm pretty sure the link is available on the website if you go to the Everyday Zen website. And if I'm wrong about the details, you'll see from the website what's the correct details. But it is on Friday. That's the day designated as Mahaprajapati Day, a really important moment to mark for all of us. So we'll go into groups, and we'll have our usual 15 or so minutes. And
recording stopped.
And my suggestion for the groups is, now we've been reading Zen Mind and thinking about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind for about a month. How's it going? What's your current feeling about Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind? How's it feel for your practice to be reading Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind again or for the first time? So let's talk about our reading of that book and what it's like. So we'll get in groups of three, and I will see you again in about 15, 17 minutes. Thank you all very much for listening to my talk. It's very, very, very sweet to have your attention, which is the most precious thing on the planet Earth is your attention. So thank you. See you in a little bit.